by the knowledge that the Bible is not a bunch of myths but is a scientific basis. One of the concerns we have is that astronomers typically presume that all Christians are younger creationists and all Christians have a very low view of science in general, and this book, if anything, may help to set that record straight, but also makes the appeal, if we're going to resolve this issue, it's got to come from within the Christian community, not outside the Christian community. Numbers of atheists have written me, and they actually support reasons to believe, saying, we know we're not going to deal with this problem from outside. It's going to take someone inside the community to make it happen. So I actually have all that in the letter. Please use the envelope attached for any contribution you wish to make toward the project. Checks should be made out to Reasons to Believe, Paradox's Book Fund, and receipts will be sent to you in the mail. So I got an envelope here. We're going to send this around. And if you want to look at the book is on the table back there. And I've got some good news for you on this project. While I was back east, I negotiated with NAB Press a deal whereby we can get books for this project at a much deeper discount. And so we should be able to get many more books in the hands of astronomers. It's not going to cost the kind of money we're talking about here. I haven't worked out a dollar price yet, but I'm looking at perhaps a factor of three, which means we'll be able to put three times as many books per dollar into the hands of astronomers. You can thank NAB Press for making that happen. So your dollars will go a lot farther, consequently. I don't know who and where I'm supposed to start this. Okay, good. And we'll get that around. And by next week, I can read to you word for word the letter I'm sending out. Want a little more time to work on editing this before we get going. This trip I took to the East Coast, I just calculated, it's the longest trip I've taken away from our home office and my family since 1989. You know, we typically have a rule at our office that when we send our speakers out, that we don't send them out for more than a week. But this is a 10-day trip. But we made an exception in this case because we were basically taking care of four projects with one trip. And rather than going back there four times, where you lose a day every time you go back there, that's the thing about going to the East Coast. It's really difficult to get anything done the day that you go. Well, this time we pulled it off. I was able to speak the night that I traveled out, mainly because I took a 6 a.m. flight. That works quite well. So get out there and then speak. But I was speaking and teaching in Georgia and North Carolina and Tennessee, and four different projects. But the night I arrived, I spoke at Georgia Tech, and you know, it was interesting because the first question I got when I was speaking at Georgia Tech was, can you tell us what the difference is between Caltech, MIT, and Georgia Tech? And I already been introduced to someone that was on the faculty of Caltech, so I said, I'm going to be really diplomatic how I answer this question. So the answer I gave was that Georgia Tech had a slightly superior football and basketball team. So slightly. And I decided not to comment on the academic quality or to mention the fact that Caltech is the only football team in the country where the average IQ of the players is higher than their average weight. Decided to let that one go. But it also ranks as the worst football team in the nation. So, but they do have really clever plays. So. Georgia Tech was good because it's summertime and the sponsors are really worried whether we're going to get any kind of decent attendance at all. But they did make an attempt to invite faculty at three universities in the downtown area. So we had professors come from not only Georgia Tech, but Emory University and Georgia State as well. And they probably made up maybe a third to half the audience. So we didn't have a lot of students, but we did have a lot of faculty. They were hoping to get 50. We had 200 show up. So they were really excited. And the Q&A session was very positive. There was a lot of anticipation that the faculty would really try to jump on the idea of the Christian interpretation of all the scientific evidence. And that didn't happen at all. In fact, I didn't hear one negative comment or complaint about the conclusions that we were drawing from the lecture on the scientific evidences for the God of the Bible. Some of that credit goes to the fact that some of the leading professors at Georgia Tech were in the audience. One of them introduced me, and they made it really clear that they're coming from a Christian perspective. And I wasn't aware that Georgia Tech was started as a Christian institution. They still have chapel at Georgia Tech. So that's something else I could have said about Georgia Tech in a positive sense, but I didn't know about that till after the lecture was over. But yeah, what's exciting for us is that some of these Georgia Tech Christian faculty are going to get involved in our Atlanta chapter. We had a really dynamic Atlanta chapter about 6 years ago. It was up around 250 members. But like a lot of our chapters in the early days, most of the leadership responsibilities fell on one or two individuals. And often they have high-tech jobs, and if you've got a high-tech job, you have a good probability of being transferred to a different city. And when that happened, the chapter kind of folded. So we're rebuilding the chapter again, but this time we're excited because we have probably 15 people committed to leadership responsibility, including faculty at these universities. So this should give the chapter a real good start. A lot of enthusiasm there. And in fact, they were responsible for supporting some of the other events that I was doing in the state of Georgia. And then we had a meeting with the chapter just to help them get organized, and that went really well, even though we held it in a noisy restaurant. But I learned a lesson. We're not going to do these meetings in noisy restaurants anymore, no matter how good the food is. We're better off having a little private room with store-bought cookies than trying to have a nice dinner in a place where you can't hear one another talk. And I was worried I was going to lose my voice, but it did work out okay. And we do have a really good start to that chapter. And the chapter we have in Huntsville, Alabama, is there to help them as well. That's a chapter that's composed almost entirely of NASA scientists and engineers. And so they're going to have a hand in trying to really get some stability under that Atlanta chapter. After that, I rented a car and drove up to the mountains of North Carolina to a place called Highlands. Let's see, what's the name of the church? Highlands Community Bible Church. Never heard of this church before, but I quickly found out this church is famous over the whole eastern seaboard. It's not a very large church. They probably have a sanctuary that seats 500, although what they did is they sponsored this intelligent design conference where they not only had their sanctuary filled up, but they had an overflow room where they had a video connection. So that held an equal number of people. And this church is famous for the fact that it's in a fairly wealthy community, and they've got money that other churches haven't got. So they were able to bring people in at considerable expense. They had invited a lot of speakers to come in and address them on the subject of intelligent design. And I heard it's a church that's got the highest density of millionaires in their congregation. So I guess that explains why they got the funds to do things. And really what I discovered is churches on the eastern seaboard depend on this church to fund things that they can't afford. And so this is one of the things they did. And the conference was sold out 2 months ago. So evidently there's a lot of interest on the East Coast on this subject of intelligent design. And it's not that easy a place to get to. It's really up in the Appalachian Mountains, quite a pretty location. Although a couple of our people were, or a couple of the participants there were saying, well, where's the air conditioning? And they just kept saying, well, we open the window, we let the mountain air come in. That's the air conditioning we have here. So we got heaters, but no air conditioning. So, but we all survived quite well, because it is up around 4,500 feet. What was interesting about that, I wasn't aware I was the first one invited to speak at this conference. I found out that the pastors of this church are really excited about Reasons to Believe. And their whole goal in getting this conference together was so that their church would get some exposure to Reasons to Believe, because nobody in our church except us has heard of you. And they really wanted to make sure we got some exposure. But they explained the only way they could get me there was to invite a whole lot of younger creationist leaders to speak as well. So a whole bunch of them were there speaking. And that's because their church is 80 to 90% younger creationists. And they said there's no way we could get you here unless we brought a whole bunch of them as well. And also they had to, I mean, the conference was on intelligent design. They said, we want you to speak on what you think are the best evidences for intelligent design. And they realized we're different from the ID folk and that we identify who the intelligent designer is. So they told me in advance, we want talks from you that make it really clear that Christ is this intelligent designer. I said, well, I wouldn't do it any other way. So this was great as far as I was concerned, but the speakers that were there from the intelligent design movement, they really just talked about evidence for intelligent design without identifying the designer, and predominantly the conference was bashing Darwinism. fact, that was the subtitle of the conference. Let me see if I got a sheet here that explains that. Here we go. What'd you know? It's my last sheet here. Yeah, it's called Intelligent Design Conference, Dispelling the Myth of Darwinism. So that was the theme from the other ID speakers, was focusing on what was wrong with Darwinism. In my talk, I decided to say nothing about Darwinism, but what is the best scientific evidence that Jesus Christ is indeed the designer and the creator of the earth, life on earth, and the human beings in particular. There were some dropouts amongst the speakers. There were supposed to be more young earth creationist speakers there. Turned out there was only two, and the two were Larry Vardaman and Russ Humphreys. And in order to keep the young earth creationists happy at the church, they literally gave the young earth creationists the freedom to talk about whatever they wanted. And they had 4 hours. I had two lectures, each 1 hour long, and they had 4 hours worth. And they decided to spend their entire 4 hours on why the scientific evidence for an old universe is wrong. That was the entire subject. What are you guys saying about intelligent design? And basically what they did, they had one sentence to say: if we can prove that the universe is young, then that proves there must be an intelligent designer. That was, they just made that one sentence and then spent the rest of their time debunking radiometric dating and explaining why astronomy does not support an old Earth. They knew I was on the platform, so they focused all their efforts on astronomy and radiometric dating. I thought, well, gee, it'd probably be wise for them to bring up some of their other arguments. That's all they did, because their whole focus is what can we do to refute Dr. Ross. So, but I told the speakers in advance, the pastors in advance, I was not going to pay attention to the young earth creationists. I said, I think they're trying to goad me, and I'm not going to fall prey to that. We have a more important job here to do, and that's give these people the best scientific evidence for Christ as a creator. And so that's kind of what I stuck with. But during the Q&A sessions, they had, this was a three-day conference, and every night they had a half hour for Q&A, which I thought was ridiculously brief. I mean, to have people there all day for 3 days and have only a half hour a day for Q&A seemed a bit limiting. And they were also concerned that the questions could be a bit inflammatory, so they were written questions. And some of the best questions simply never made it up to the microphone. There were a lot of physicists in the audience. I was surprised, because I could look back, and they were all sitting behind me, and every time one of these younger speakers got up, they were all wincing together. So that kind of gave it away, and they sent up some great questions, but their questions really didn't get answered. Yeah, a little bit technical, so we were talking about how you can make that work. However, I did get a total on the 3 nights of 5 minutes to respond to the 4 hours of lectures. And actually, the younger creations didn't make that good use of their time. They basically have one talk that they give. And so I was amazed to hear Larry Vardaman give the same talk that Russ Humphreys gave with very little variation. But their whole, I asked them why afterwards they did that, and they said the audience needs to hear this over and over again. So we decided to give it to them twice. So, but it was really interesting. The whole thing on radiometric dating is that they're finding carbon-14 in fossils. They're finding it in coal. They're finding it in diamonds, and they're finding it in zircons, and they're finding it all at the same level. And so I figure, well, the audience is going to figure this out. But I was naive. Nobody in the audience figured out the flaw in that kind of. Well, the physicists behind me did. And they were also just as shocked as I was that the people in the audience didn't figure it out. But their whole point was that we see carbon-14 in all these things that the scientists tell us are very old, then that means that the evidence for an old Earth and an old universe is all bogus. That was kind of their main point. But I think you here in the class can figure it out. If you're getting the same carbon-14 level in the fossils that are dated to be old, and in the coal, and the diamonds, and the zircons, then doesn't that mean there must be some kind of residual background explaining the carbon-14? Otherwise, why would you get the same answer for all of them? But I was surprised that people in the audience didn't figure that out. And one of the physicists did make the comment, well, since the Earth's crust is filled with uranium and thorium, won't that by itself explain the carbon 14? And Russ Humphreys got up and said, no, of course it doesn't, and just went on to the next question. I said, oh, this is an opportunity for someone to explain to the audience why that was a killer against their whole argument that carbon 14 residuals were proving this. But just to explain it to all of you here, what's happening is if you've got radiation in the Earth's crust, and the Earth's crust is filled with radiometric elements, that radiation is going to affect the nitrogen that's in the environment and turn into carbon 14. And therefore, of course, you're always going to get a base residual, a base background of carbon 14 measurements in any sample you pick up. Any sample that's had contact with the Earth's crust should give you that base sample. But to me, this is a classic argument of trying to pull one over on lay people who don't have a technical background to really appreciate or evaluate the argument. And that's what I really felt bad. The audience simply didn't have, wasn't given the right to properly evaluate the argument. However, the comment I got after the conference was all over is that in terms of the debate, my 5 minutes against their 4 hours, they said they lost. So I was able to get enough into the 5 minutes to really raise some serious doubts. And probably the most effective thing I made mention of is that Larry Vardaman was talking all about ice ages and carbon 14. And so I made a comment about the paper I discussed with you before I took off on the trip. Remember that paper we discussed about that ice core, 740,000 layers deep, and how those layers must be annual layers? Well, it was interesting how Larry made reference to all these periodicities in the Earth's orbit and tried to use that as a claim that the old Earth evidence was invalid. But this ice core actually revealed the very things he was talking about. So just taking a minute to explain to the audience that they had found this deep core, that they had found all these cycles of the Earth. You can see the 26,000-year cycle due to precession, the 41,000-year cycle due to the periodicity of the obliquity of the Earth's orbit, the tilt of the Earth's orbit, and then the periodicity and the variation of the eccentricity of the Earth's orbit, which is 100,000 years. And you can see all three cycles neatly showing up with peaks in this 740,000-year layer, and also the point that you can see the dust from volcanic eruptions that show up in recorded history. I mean, you can see Krakatoa, you can see Vesuvius eruption that wiped out Pompeii, you can count the number of layers between them, and it verifies that indeed they're annual layers. Or you can see there's 41,000 layers in between one peak of the periodicity that pertains to the obliquity of Earth's orbit and the next one, and indeed you do. In fact, you see a whole bunch of them. You see about 20 of them that covering the whole time scale. That little point probably scored more points than anything these guys said in their 4 hours. So, and I think God just gave me the wisdom, pick something simple. And then the speaker asked me to pick something from, because Russ Humphreys gave an hour of lecture on why astronomers are lying to you about the evidence that the universe is old. And so the moderator said, Hugh, we haven't got a lot of time here, but just pick one. And so I said, well, if I have to pick one, I'll talk about the supernova remnants. Because again, that was probably the simplest. He talked about comets, he talked about supernova remnants, he talked about the white hole model, the expansion of the universe. But I figured the one that the audience will probably be able to grasp the easiest is his arguments about supernova remnants. And his whole point is that when a supernova explodes, you get an expanding shell coming off the supernova. And he says, we know that the universe must be young because we don't see any big shells, which means they haven't been expanding that long. And then he just kind of let it go at that. And so I said, well, what he told you is correct in one context only. We don't see expanded supernova remnants in the vicinity of the sun. And so there's a good reason why we don't see them. The sun is a region of our galaxy where there's been a lot of past supernova, and therefore there's a background of diffuse supernova remnants. They all kind of expand up, but then they blend into one another. So when a new supernova explodes, it'll expand for a while, but after a while it gets so large it just blends into the background. You can't see it anymore. I said, you know, if we look beyond the immediate neighborhood of the sun and look into the halo where supernova, the halo of our galaxy where supernova aren't as frequent, there we see shells where we can calculate an expansion age in excess of 4 million years. And if we go to other galaxies where they have a much lesser supernova rate, like the Small Magellanic Cloud, that's a dwarf galaxy orbiting our galaxy, there we see many supernova remnants whose expanded shell diameter measures to be in excess of several million years. So just picking something simple, I think, really helped. But it was encouraging to me that people felt that my 5 minutes was able to overcome their 4 hours. Yeah. Well, there was, okay, at one point I did give a response to Russ Humphreys on, because another big argument he had was that the radiometric decay rates are not constant. And that's why you can't trust what the astronomers are telling you, because if you go back into the past, they were decaying a million times faster. And so, in that case, the radiometric dates do not prove an old universe. And I was given a minute to respond to that. Russ Humphreys was given a minute to respond to my minute, and I was given 30 seconds to respond to his 1 minute. But, you know, my whole point was we can go back in time and look. If we look at the Crab Nebula, that's 7,000 light years away. It took the light 7,000 years to reach us, and we can measure the radiometric decay rates that far back. And so I said, on that basis, we know they're constant. And I thought what really scored well with the audience, I said, we know it's constant what the Bible says. So I quoted a few Bible verses that make the point that the laws that govern the heavens and the earth are fixed. So, and then looked at Romans 8, where it talks about the second law of thermodynamics applying to the entire creation, back to the creation event itself. And that's something I've learned over the years, that when you're dealing with younger creationists, the biblical arguments score a lot more weight than the scientific arguments do. Russ, in his response, just said, well, when we look at radiometric decay inside zircons, we have a helium problem and we have a lead problem. We don't, you know, the diffusion rates are such that it invalidates the radiometric dates. I just kind of went back and said, you know, if I respond to that one, it's going to be too complex. In 30 seconds, there's no way I can respond to that point. So I simply went back to the point that we can demonstrate that these are constant and that short-lived radiometric elements are no longer visible in the solar system. There's a second reason why they cannot be very different in the past than they are in the present. But that's a favorite tactic I see from younger creationists, is in their rebuttals to bring up points that are so complex. They know that if you try to respond to it quickly, the audience won't be able to follow you, or you'll have to ignore it, and they'll be claimed the winner of the debate. So, I think their whole, I mean, it's hard for me to judge them, but it seems to me that their motivation is they have to be right. And it may explain the fact that most of them have a rather legalistic theological paradigm worked out, too. Making mistakes, sinning, is just the worst thing that can happen. And the whole idea that, hey, we're sinners, we make mistakes, and when we do, we repent, and people forgive us, and we move on. That doesn't seem to be part of their theological system. So it's really important for them that they be right, and they're convinced they are right. They really are convinced I'm trying to deceive the public. So, I mean, that's in their thinking. And, by the way, it's not true of all young Earth creationists, but certainly the two I was facing at that conference have that ilk. I recommend it to the sponsors that they invite some other young Earth creationists to speak besides these two. But they said, no, these are the two our people want. They will insist on these two. So that's the way it went. But just to be really fair, there are young Earth creationists that don't play those kinds of games. But these are the ones that are the most widely published. Yeah. It's just water. Well, that's a very good point. I mean, if you believe the Earth is young, why are stars dying? But again, their whole basis is to say that things were different in the past. And these two speakers in particular are trying to put all the change physics at two points in history, at the flood and at the time that Adam fell into sin. You know, during those two epochs, they claim that physics was radically different and that things that appear to take a long time wouldn't take that much time because of those two episodes. In other words, they would hypothesize that there's extreme stellar aging going on during the 13-month flood or at the time that Adam fell into sin, or a combination of the two. That was a standard answer they gave every time. But one physicist brought up the point, well, you know, if you're going to do all that damage during the flood, how does Noah survive the flood? You know, it's a very good answer. But it never got read. He talked to me and told me he read that question out. So, yeah. Yeah, lots. I mean, I met a whole lot at the conference who came up to me and said, you know, reading Creation and Time is what turned me completely around on this issue. And it was really encouraging is how many people came up to me who were really involved in Christian apologetics. Thank you. And I made the comment that it was one of my books that brought him to faith in Christ. So, and creation, the creator in the cosmos is the one that gets... I probably had six people come up to me and say the creator in the cosmos brought him to Christ. But I had two say that Creation and Time was the book that brought him to Christ. And the Genesis question, I had about four say they came to Christ through reading that. So to hear that at a conference is very encouraging. Yeah. Well, you know, the thrill of being, I mean, when you're in Georgia and Tennessee and North Carolina, you're in the Bible Belt. And what I'm realizing about Bible Belt folks, they've only been taught one thing, the young earth perspective. And when they hear something different, they really come alive. I mean, I've never seen such an enthusiastic response to our messages as I saw at that North Carolina church. By the way, all of our books, we had a lot of books there, more books than anybody else had. They had these, you know, tables for the different organizations. We had just this one small table. But we came with a lot of books. But all the books were gone before I got up to the podium to speak. So I didn't speak the first day. And this book was gone about 35 minutes after the conference opened. People came and just snatched that off. The Origins of Life book, it lasted about an hour and 5 minutes. And we had two boxes of each. So rest of the speakers there and organizations, they took home a lot of books. Ours were gone. So that was even before they heard of us. There's a lot of hunger in the Bible Belt for something that really does fit the evidence scientifically and biblically. And I can't tell you how many people came up to me just thanked me for coming there and presenting a perspective they had never heard before. So the opportunities are there. And I think sometimes my astronomer colleagues have this opinion of the Christian community. And they simply don't understand the way the Bible Belt operates and how closed in it is. But that was the experience I had all over Georgia, Tennessee, and North Carolina. People really do get excited. And there's a lot of people that are looking for something. I mean, it's like they kind of know in their heart that this young earth thing just isn't fitting all the way together. But they feel this is the only way they can hold to a Bible that's inerrant, so they stick with it. And they hear an alternative that, where you don't have to give up the integrity of Scripture or the inerrancy of Scripture, and you can have integrity and credibility in the scientific end, they jump for it. So it's one of the most enthusiastic audiences I've ever addressed. Yes. Well, I could probably put it this way. You know, what I'm discovering, not just in the Bible Belt but other places, is that, at least from my perspective, you're dealing with a whole lot of astronomical literacy. You know, people are aware there's planets out there. But in terms of galaxies, I mean, I don't think our schools are telling the students very much at all about objects beyond our Milky Way. I mean, you know, the quasars are a complete mystery to them, black holes. I mean, they may have heard a little bit about black holes and some science fiction movies, but that's primarily what we're dealing with. And that was a shock to me when I came to the United States. I expected Americans to have a fairly basic education in astronomy. What I am discovering is that they usually have a fairly decent knowledge of the solar system. You can count on the fact that they do have some education of the solar system, but beyond the solar system, not much. And I'm wondering to what degree that's a Bible Belt phenomenon, because what I've been seeing in the school board cases in Kansas and Ohio and Georgia is where, you know, this whole creation evolution thing, what comes out of it is a mandate that we're going to make the teaching of astronomy, astronomical objects more distant than Pluto, an option. So it seems to be a recognition that anything more distant than Pluto is a challenge to a young Earth paradigm, and therefore there's not a lot of teaching going on stuff more distant than Pluto. You know, and I took astronomy in elementary school and junior high school. We got a lot of stuff more distant than Pluto. But as I've talked to Americans, yeah, usually when they get an astronomy course in high school, it's pretty well solar system physics, and that's it. So that may be part of it. I'm talking public schools. Yeah, public schools, you don't get much beyond the solar system. So they learn all about eclipses and stuff, and they learn about Isaac Newton and you know, Tycho Brahe and how they figured out all the planetary motion, which is good stuff. I'm glad they're getting that. But once you get beyond Pluto, not a whole lot. So that may be a big part of the problem. But the other thing I find interesting, audiences are excited to learn more about astronomy. I mean, astronomy is where you get confronted with the big questions. Why is all that stuff there? What is my place in the universe? Who am I? And that obviously leads to a lot of good philosophy and theology. But you really don't get confronted with that until you really look out to the farthest depths of the cosmos. That's really what it takes. They've heard of that, but they don't understand it. That's the problem. I mean, they've heard about the maps, the W map, and but you know, you ask them, well, you know, what is the W map? They can't tell you. So that to me is kind of sad that, you know, they've heard of these things, but they have no understanding or capacity to explain it. Yeah. Compared to the West, yeah, Southern Baptist is far more predominant than it is in other parts of the country. Almost all the churches are Baptist churches. And yes, younger creationism is 90% plus all over the South. That would be an accurate assessment. Younger creationism, right. Yeah, so that's why it's so difficult for me to get a speaking engagement in the South. But it happened this time, so that was good. Pardon me? Watch out for the Ku Klux Klan, right? So, but it was really good at that church, and the pastor said, you know, of all the speakers we've had here, you're the one we want back. And they asked me questions about the rest of our team. They said, you know, we're really going to see if we can get your team to come out by themselves. So that'd be really great. So we'll see if that can happen. They said, we have an impact on the whole Eastern Seaboard. And yeah, I saw how the church operates. They really do. It was a pleasure for me to meet up again with Charles Saxton. He's the last scientist to write a book on the origin of life from a Christian perspective. We were selling them here in the class, so they sold out. That was 20 years ago. And Charles has been traveling around the world sharing the scientific evidences for the God of the Bible. And it's incredible what he's been through. I mean, when he was teaching in Czechoslovakia and in Poland, he got a big cancer in his leg, and he wound up losing his leg. So, in fact, he was asking me questions. He said, you know, when I had this cancer in my leg, I got a phone call from the American Embassy whether I could be flown back to the States for the operation. I said, I have no idea where that came from. He says, Charlie, I can tell you about that. We were having a conference in San Diego, and news of your leg situation came to us, and we actually passed the hat around, got some money to get a medevac, and we contacted the embassy and everything. But what Hannah found out there is that they found a Polish hospital that was excellently equipped to deal with the cancer in his leg. And what he later found out is if he was flown to the hospital in Dallas, his cancer was so fast growing, he would have been dead by the time he got to the operating table. He said those Polish doctors, because he got operated on within an hour after the phone call with the embassy, and it saved his life. And I had no idea how bad it was, but he told me the cancer in his thigh was so bad that his thigh was more than two times its diameter, its normal diameter. So they did save his life. But then he told me in another bout with the cancer a year and a half ago, and again it was the same thing, a rapidly growing cancer in his lung, and they said, you know, it's consumed your whole lung, and we can't operate. And I said, well, what are my options? They said, well, we can give you a little bit of chemotherapy, and that might, you know, give you another month or two. And so they did that, and the cancer shrunk 60%. And they looked at it and said, now we can operate. And they took the entire lung out, and it saved his life again. So he said, I think God wants me alive for a reason. So, but he has no leg, and he's missing one lung, and he's still out there on the speaking circuit. So God's using him to great impact, and he goes all over the world to speak. But a marvelous man of faith, and it was just really encouraging to talk to him. The thing I like about Charles Saxton, he not only talks to people about the scientific evidences for God, he really gets down to their personal relationship with Christ and what this can do to their marriage, to their family, and you know, their relationships with others. He's got a real gift for doing that. And yeah, I think God really has performed a couple of miracles. Because what the doctor said when he saw that cancer shrink 60%, he said, you know, if you're at all religious, you need to go to your church and tell people that God performed a miracle for you. Because I've been doing this for 35 years. I've never seen this ever happen. To anybody with a cancer like this, they're dead within 30 or 40 days. He says, this is a miracle. And I said, I'm not a believer, but if you are, you need to tell people that a miracle's happened in your life. And I'll back it up. So, yeah, well, I mean, again, that was one of the highlights of my time there, was just talking to Charles Saxton. So, I told him, you need to write this up. I mean, you know, these two stories together, and just the impact of your ministry, is you really need to talk about it. So, and the other thing that was interesting for both Charles and me is that they had this little thing about, you know, who's come the farthest to this conference? And people are saying, well, I came from Texas, and actually there was one guy from England, one came from Nicaragua, and one came from Ecuador, and then this young lady stood up and said, Mongolia. So she won the prize. But you know, that Mongolian gal was a translator for both Charles Saxton and me when we were in Ulaanbaatar. She was the one that translated the Journey Toward Creation video for broadcast throughout Mongolia. So it's just fun for Charles and I to make contact with her again. But she clearly won the prize for coming the farthest. So she's actually a student here at Biola. She's getting a master's in apologetics and is going to go back. She already has a master's degree in biochemistry. So, coming back from North Carolina, I went to a place called Johnson Ferry Baptist Church. Apparently in Atlanta, they have all these ferries. I don't know what they're all about, because everywhere you go, there's somebody's ferry going on. But this is like an 8,000-member church. So it's one of Atlanta's largest churches. And I taught the Sunday school class that William Craig teaches. He was up at another conference, so I took over his classes. The class a lot like this. Only they have 200 people in the class instead of our, you know, 100, circa 100. But the church is really good at publicizing the class. They get a lot of visitors, just like we do. And they wanted me to talk about some latest discoveries. So I talked to them about that discovery I mentioned with you, where they found out that the late heavy bombardment created a liquid magma ocean 600 kilometers, how this gave us just the right core, and So and I tied it into the origin of life, how it demonstrates that the origin of life must have happened in a geological instant, and how even the great disasters that have impacted the Earth are all exquisitely designed to make life possible on the Earth. Kind of the context of what you see in Genesis 1. The world was formless and void. But even the formless and void part is exquisitely designed. And all these incredible disasters that have been falling the Earth are actually very carefully fine-tuned events to prepare the Earth for human beings. Again, they just got really excited. A lot of younger creationists in the class, and I found out that Bill had a hard time getting this class going in his church. They really wanted him to teach because of his reputation, but they said, this church is filled with younger creationists, and we don't want you touching that subject. So he's had to very carefully work out a curriculum where that subject never comes up. But in my case, it's kind of hard. As soon as you're introduced as an astronomer, it's a giveaway. Right away you're viewed as the enemy to be destroyed. So that was most of the questions I fielded afterwards. And a couple of the senior pastors were there watching. And they said, we thought this was just going to be a tremendous explosion in this church. And I said, nobody got upset. And I said, they really appreciated the fact that I was real gentle with the younger creationists and handled it well. And several of the younger creationists came up afterwards and said, this has really convinced me that the old Earth paradigm is really the way to go. And it's like they all know that Bill is old Earth anyway. But as I was talking to the pastors, maybe we can give Bill a little more freedom in the class here. So they're actually thinking about that. But another challenge of trying to minister in the South. While I was there, I did a lot of radio and TV interviews. And, when you're in the South, at least from my perspective, everywhere you go, it's culture shock. The food's different. I don't like high-fat food, and the Southern cooking is just loaded with that stuff, so I kind of try to pick around it to find something I can eat without bothering me. But a real example of culture shock was when I was waiting for my TV interview. This is at the Christian Booksellers Convention. And the people all in front of me were rock stars. And I said, I thought this is a booksellers convention. But what I realized is that the predominant item being sold at the Christian Booksellers Convention is music, and particularly Christian rock music. And this one gal was being interviewed. She was only 24 years old. She's the CEO of a record company, and she has all these Christian artists that they work for. So she was being interviewed, and there was a gal interviewing her, and it was the same gal who was going to be interviewing me. And so I listened to them talk while I was waiting for my interview because they were late. Is that I said, boy, this is going to be really tough because all they're talking about is fashion and food and dieting and music. How am I going to connect with this? So, it was quite clear. Because I heard the host talking to the other people. I said, I don't think this gal has ever been educated on science. What am I going to do? And they all have an entourage. It's not just this one person walking in. There's about a dozen people are walking with them. Anyway, this gal left, and then this other guy barged in. Actually, he didn't. His entourage came in first, and they looked at me there and said, is there any way we can have you wait? We know your turn is next, but our rock star, Rudy, has a tight schedule. And he said, well, I got a fairly tight schedule, too. I got a book signing coming up at 11. And they said, well, we think you can make that, but it's really important to get this guy in and get him out. And I said, well, okay, I'll wait, and you can do the interview. And then this guy barged in. I never heard of him, but his first name is Bebo, and apparently he's a really famous Christian artist. Young man, and he's probably about 31, 32. But he's already sold in the millions. Anyway, he barged in there, took one look at me, and said, you're Hugh Ross. And I said, yeah, I am. And he says, you're my hero, and I've read all your books. It turns out before he got into rock music, he was a biology teacher. He's got a biology degree, and he told me about some of the songs he's written where he's used my material to do the song. And he said, while I'm waiting, because we're still waiting for the other interview to get over, and he said, I got a whole bunch of questions. So he started firing questions at me, but fortunately the host heard all those questions, and he said, this is exactly what I need to interview you. So it wasn't for that rock star guy barging in there like that, the interview would have been, I've been talking about food and fashion, right? Which is not exactly my forte. So, but thanks to Bebo, he was able to give enough clues and to the host where she was able to kind of give me a good interview. And she was supposed to interview me about Cassini and Saturn, and she just says, look, I know nothing about Saturn or Cassini. Says, I know nothing about astronomy. I know nothing about biochemistry. But she says, how about if I just ask you a couple of questions about your books? So I said, fine, we'll talk about the books. So we talked about both The Matter Days and Origins of Life. And she was really relieved when the interview was over, but she says, no, I think this is my best interview of the day. So I have something called Women's Today Radio, and I thought, well, I wonder what this is going to be like. So, but this is a show that Bonnet Bright has. She's the husband of Bill Bright, and she still carries on his radio ministry. But again, it was kind of a surprise for me. I walked into the studio and they said, well, you know, here's some questions we want you to answer. And I'd never seen the questions before. They're just brand new. So I looked at the questions and said, okay, are you going to ask me the questions? And I responded and said, no. What we're going to do is have you read the questions, you give a response, and it's going to go on tape, and then we're going to transcribe, and Bonnet Bright's going to read it. And I said, oh, Bonnet Bright's going to be reading this. And he says, yeah, we'll just kind of edit some things out. And I said, well, it might be a good idea for me to see those edits before she reads them, because they're all rather complex science issues. So they said, well, we'll make an exception. So apparently we are going to be able to see it before it quote gets read. That was kind of an interesting experience for me, is, you know, actually reading the question and giving the answer straight out, having it all go down to tape. So, and then I had two other radio interviews where the hosts were younger creationists. You want to know what their first question was to me each time? Okay, Dr. Ross, tell us why the Big Bang is a false paradigm. And I said, well, actually, I take a little different perspective on that. But their whole point was the Big Bang is anti-biblical, it's anti-Christian, and please give us some proof against the Big Bang. So I said, well, I guess these people don't know who I am, but we managed to get around that, as difficult as it was. But I was on this one talk show where they're going to open up the phone lines, but the host was so nervous he refused to open up the phone line. Yeah, he just tried to control it so that the phone lines would never get dealt with. I mean, that's too bad, because I think sometimes that's the best thing, is when you're talking to people who come in over the phone. Then I spent a couple of days at the Christian Booksellers Convention, and again, it's hardly books anymore. It's about 10% books and 50% music, and what I call, well, not what I call, but we have a philosopher on our staff, and it refers to the other 40% with the term Christian junk. You know, these are things like jewelry and, you know, bookmarks and stuff like that. But it's really what's on the floor. It's just all this stuff. Little trinkets. I call it Christian trinkets. I think that's a more appropriate term. The books really are way down the list. But I had a number of bookstore owners come up to me and say, tell me how many of their customers have come to Christ through a book. That was really good. The other thing that was sad is how many bookstore owners came up to me and said, you know, we're not allowed to even put your books on the shelf or to sell them. I said, well, a number of bookstores will put them in the back in the warehouse and then bring them. I said, no, not our chain. Our chain, the owners are all younger creationists, and they've all sent us a letter that anything by Hugh Ross is not to be carried at all by the store. So that's the way it goes. But again, Bible Belt mentality. But one guy just came up to me and said, you know, I am a younger creationist, but I watched that televised debate between you and Ken Hovind. And as a younger creationist, I don't think Ken Hovind did very well. And so he asked me a lot of questions about the background of that debate, because he was really frustrated that Ken Hovind never produced any evidence for a young Earth. I said, well, John Ankerberg was really frustrated that he wouldn't do it either. And I said, each ad break, John would go to Ken Hovind and say, present your evidence, present your evidence. And Kent never did. He just came back with a lot of name-calling. And at the end, John Ankerberg came up to me and said, can you explain why Kent Hovind would not present his evidence, even though I repeatedly asked him to? I said, because there was an astronomer that was confronting him. That's why he didn't do it. That's all I said. And John said, oh, very interesting. Then he called me about a week later and said, you know, I don't think I'm going to call myself a younger creationist anymore. That debate really did turn him around. Well, as one guy was talking to me, he said, well, I'm still a younger creationist. I said, it may be just because of where I live, but he said, I want to read your book. So he actually took a copy of his book and said he was going to read it. And but he did say that he really does appreciate the attitude, the Christian attitude he gets from old earth creation. It's much more than young earth creation. There's a lot of hope that this thing can get resolved, from my perspective. Yeah. Well, a lot of what I hear from the young earth community is that God did indeed make the universe in a very complex way, that even though it's young, it appears to be old. And this is God's tool to show the pride and the deception of the educated class out there. What God is trying to do is expose to the population at large what happens to people who have a lot of intellect and a lot of education. They get consumed with pride and they wind up co-opting with the side of the devil. And so that's their explanation of what's going on there. Hey, I only got some few minutes left. I actually wanted to get into our Book of Job discussion here. But the final thing I did, and I'm skipping a few things I did. I was there 10 days. But one of the more significant things I did was at the end of the trip where John Ankerberg had invited me and Walter Kaiser to do a set of 6 television episodes. And basically what's happened to John, he was a younger creationist, and thanks to the debate, he came over to the older perspective. He read the book, The Genesis Debate, and he said that really solidified it for him, and he wound up endorsing his book. You'll see his endorsement in the back of the book. And when he did some episodes with Buzz Ronick, Ken Samples, and myself, we did 9 shows, basically kind of looking at the anthropic principle, the Big Bang creation event, the origin of life, and kind of walk people through Genesis 1. Never really dealt with the old earth, young earth issue at all in that talk. We're looking at the scientific case for the Christian faith. But he wound up getting some very nasty letters and articles written about him by the young earth community. And, you know, John's not like me. When people do that to him, he gets mad. And so he said, okay, I've got the media, they don't. We're going to do 6 shows on the old earth, young earth issue. And he said, we're going to bring in the country's top Hebrew scholar. So it's not just going to be a scientist and a lawyer, it's going to be, you know, someone who's really a heavyweight on the theological side. And Walter Kaiser, since the death of Gleason Archer, certainly has that mantle. There's really no one out there who has the stature and the scholarship of Walter Kaiser. And so we did those shows. That was kind of the last thing I did now is back east there in Chattanooga. But we wound up doing 8 shows instead. John got so carried away, so let's do another show. So we got 8 episodes done. And he said, I'm going to really get negative mail for this. But he said, you know what, we need to get past this issue. And that was kind of the theme of the 8 shows, is that this is a controversy that really needs to get resolved. And it's time to get past this controversy and get on to the more important task of reaching a hungry world for Christ. Because this older and younger thing is really stopping people from hearing the best evidences for the Christian faith. So, yeah, Jackie. They will air on 2 satellite networks, the Inspiration Network, and there's another, I think it's called Sky Angel. It'll be on the Sky Angel network, so it'll be on those 2 shows. And what Ankerberg is going to do is show these 8 shows and immediately follow it up with the 9 episodes. He's going to repeat the 9 episodes that Buzz and Ken and I did with him. So, his whole point is he wants to roll up his sleeves and get involved and be a force to bringing resolution to this issue. And I thought he did a really good job in the 8 episodes. It will probably air in September, is what I've been told. But it could be as early as August. He's going to try to get it started in the middle of August. It all depends how much time it takes for them to edit and prepare them. He wants to put video clips in. They're nationwide, but not everybody gets those 2 networks on there. I think you get it once through a dish and once through a cable. However, I can tell you this just from my own experience. The exposure we got from those 9 episodes, we got a bigger response from that than we did all the TBN shows we've done for the past 2 years. You know, and that's on 1,000 stations. So, and then we will wind up getting a video master. So we'll be able to use that and turn it into a product. So if you can't get those two networks, we eventually will get it. Yeah. Yeah, he does broadcast on his website. Yeah, johnankerberg.com. So, it gets a decent exposure. So, and again, it was just really fun dealing with Ankerberg staff. They were most encouraging towards us. They were all younger. They're no longer younger. So things are really happening there. And again, for them, that debate really made a difference. So that was most encouraging. But meeting Walt was fun, too. I hadn't seen Walt in 10 years. And he's still a real, I mean, he's 71 years old, but still a real, he's got a gentle spirit about him. And that's kind of what I liked about these 8 episodes. The young Earth creationists were not put down. We just really spent most of our time talking about the Bible, very little about the scientific evidence. And that was kind of the role I played. I was a scientist, but I was jumping in. Kind of the role we played is that Walt focused on exegeting the different words and phrases in the Hebrew creation text. And my role was to say, well, it's not just Genesis 1. It's not just the flood account. We have accounts outside of Genesis. And hey, just what we've been doing here in the class, you go to Job 38, you go to Psalm 104, and the stuff that Christians fight about in Genesis chapter 1 and 2 are resolved when you go to those accounts. So that was kind of the role I played. I just kept bouncing us to other creation texts in the Bible, which clarify points that may not be abundantly clear in the book of Genesis. People fight because they can't get their nose outside the book of Genesis. So again, I want to thank all the participants here in the class. I think what was really encouraging is to just look at this whole controversy. Were the stars created on the fourth day? And to realize right in Job 38, verse 8, it says that the earth's oceans were enshrouded in darkness, encapsulated with darkness, because God used the clouds as a dark blanket to enshroud it. And now you go back to Genesis 1 and say, okay, what's really going on in the first creation day is this is when God transformed the atmosphere. There was an opaque atmosphere. God transformed it so that light could pass through. And you know, it's really quite clear when you look at Job 38:8. That's the interpretation to make on Genesis 1. And that being the case, when you get to the fourth day, that must be a reference to the clouds becoming transparent instead of translucent. The stars have been there all along. And then you know, Walt kept backing me up by saying, well, let me show you what exactly the Hebrew is saying in verse 16 of Genesis 1 and verse 14, 15. I thought we worked really well together. But you're going to love his jokes. He's got jokes. So, a lot of jokes I've heard 40 years ago, but they're good jokes. So, that was a good time. Well, let me spend a couple of minutes in our text here. We actually are in Job 38. And that was something that was a bit of a revelation to both Walt and John, is to realize when you go through Psalm 104 and Job 38, it really is a reflection on Genesis 1. And that's kind of what we've been doing here in Genesis and Job 38, is going through the text and picking out where it refers to the six creation days. And all six creation days are mentioned. And I really appreciated Walt where he said, you know, this is really right. Poetry is set up where it doesn't follow the strict chronology of prose passages. And the value of poetry is that you can get these parallelisms and comparisons. And that's one reason why when you go through Job 38, the content in the six creation days jumps around. I mean, you've been hearing me say, for almost every single creation day in Genesis 1, you get three separate passages in Job 38 that reflect on that day. And what makes it challenging is sometimes one little paragraph will reflect on two creation days at the same time. But that's poetry. And Walt gave a really good description of why Hebrew poetry is different from English poetry. He believes that a lot of the reason why these creation accounts have been ignored is people don't appreciate the difference between Hebrew poetry and English poetry. You know, how in English poetry, rhyme is everything. But how in Hebrew poetry, rhyme is usually not paid attention to at all. In English poetry, it's all about cadence, getting the same number of syllables in each little phrase so that they match up equally. what so is really going on in Hebrew poetry is they're looking at contrasting ideas and trying to pull them together. That's part of the poetic beauty. They also make a reference to words that sound the same and so or have different meanings. They'll use the same word, but it's got two different meanings. Whereas the English language, almost all of our words have unique meanings. And that really helped people understand what's going on with the Hebrew word yom. Because Walt was able to go through parts of Job 38 and say, you know, what's going on here? We have this beautiful poetry that takes advantage of the fact that a single word has three or four different literal definitions. And that's actually built into the poetry. And you can't do that with English because most of our English words don't work that way. Hebrew is a small vocabulary, so it's forced to work that way. That was a really interesting way to get across the point that this word yom has four different literal definitions. Because in between the shows, that was his point. He says, these young earth creations don't understand that there are multiple literal definitions. And we really need to get that point across by using examples that are outside of the context of that word yom. And it worked pretty well when we got into Psalm 104 and then Job 38. So that might be something I try to do with you in our next time together, to just point out some of these poetic tools that are used in the Hebrew that we hardly ever use when we do English poetry. In fact, Walt just made a joke at one point that the problem is that people studying these texts have had too much English literature, and we've taken too many poetry classes. And our presumption is that English poetry is something that is ubiquitous to all the different languages. And it says it may work on the Indo-European languages, but not the Semitic languages. They're different. So, but I mean, we've got people here in the class that come from different language backgrounds, and I think we can appreciate that English chauvinism that's going on here. So, but one of the things that was really great was just to bring out the creation day three, because we did two shows on the flood, and how these creation texts, Job 38 and Psalm 104 and Proverbs 8, really nail in a definitive way the extent of the Genesis flood. That it was universal but not global. Because what do we see here in the text? That God separated the waters, creating oceans and land continents. What does Psalm 104 say? Never again will the waters cover the face of the earth. So in the context of creation day three, those waters would never again cover the face of the earth. Therefore, the Genesis flood cannot be global in extent. And you've got five passages. Remember the five? Psalm 33, Job 38, Psalm 104, Proverbs 8, and 2 Peter 3 that back up that conclusion that the flood of Genesis cannot be global in extent. Yeah. In fact, I'll give you the exact verses. Okay, Psalm 33, verses 6 to 9. Psalm 104, verses 6 to 9. Proverbs 8, verses 24 to 29. And 2 Peter 3, verse 6. And in Job 38, it's verse 5 and carry it down to verse 11. Although 8 through 11, huh? 2 Peter 3, 6. The world at the time the event took place. The very fact that Peter qualifies that the world of the time of Noah is different from the world of his time. And the world of his time was the Roman world. Where you have in Luke chapter 2 that Caesar Augustus decreed that the whole world would be taxed. Obviously the Incas weren't paying any taxes. The Chinese weren't paying any taxes. It was the Roman world that was taxed. And it was the same Peter that said that the faith of the Romans had been heard throughout the whole world. But his world was bigger than the world of Noah. Yeah. Could it be that he's anticipating this controversy would be around today? Yeah. Well, there's a lot of stuff that we're going to find in Job 38, Psalm 104, and Proverbs 8 that have value for people living in the 20th and 21st centuries alone. So this is consistent with what you see in 1 Peter, where he makes the statement that these prophets of old were inspired by God to write scripture that they themselves did not understand. And we're content with the fact that this is the message for a future generation to understand. So I think that's important. And in terms of the Bible is not meant to be understood in toto by all the people reading it. I mean, Jesus kind of brought that out when he explains to his disciples the fulfillment of certain prophecies. People living before Christ couldn't understand what these scriptures are all about. After Christ, they did. Well, likewise, there's plenty of stuff that we're going to be looking at that really doesn't have appropriate communication, understanding until the 20th and 21st century. So a lot of this is written for us. And there's a lot of stuff here that is beyond us. In my opinion, I don't think we're in a position to really comprehend the fullness of the message of Ezekiel chapter 40 through to 48 at future time. I've run into people who think they understand it, but when asking questions, their understanding is really not much better than mine. So, hard time's up. So, Father in Heaven, we thank you that you've given us a book that really does cross the ages. Lord, that a book that's written for every generation. People of the time of Moses and Job had plenty that they could understand. And we appreciate the fact that your Bible has written this simply for all generations, but it's also written with such depth that no matter how deep our learning and our education, no matter how advanced our technology, no matter how advanced our capacity to use hindsight to look over the millennia of the past ages, there's still more to be learned from this text. Thank you for giving us an inexhaustible record. And pray, Father, you give each of us the motivation to pursue extra gems of wisdom and insight from this book, that we may profit from it, not just in terms of gaining greater understanding of who you are and a role with respect to you, but, Lord, that it would change our life, it would change our character into the image of your Son, Jesus Christ. In Jesus' name, amen.